It's good to see everyone's faces. It's sweet actually to be able to see everyone like this. This evening, I actually, a little bit unexpectedly, wanted to continue some of the energy from last time, from a week ago when I was honoring the life and teaching of the great teacher Thich Nhat Hanh. And there was a part of my presentation that looked at the way that Thich Nhat Hanh had, in a sense, expanded our usual sense of ethics and brought them into the intensity of the situation in Vietnam. And I talked somewhat briefly about that understanding of the ethical dimension of our practice. And one person suggested that we explore that broad view of ethics a little bit more. So that's what I want to do, you know, with still with a grounding in the life and work of Thich Nhat Hanh, but more broadly, look at the five basic ethical precepts. And last time I looked somewhat briefly at two of them, and to point to the importance of how we look at our ethical practice. It's an area that's often relatively neglected in Buddhist practice, which is so meditation centered so much. You know, we sometimes give some lip service to ethics, but in the traditional setting, in Asia, for example, the training that we would go through or that people would go through was understood as having three aspects. Training, and many of you know, in wisdom, in meditation, and also in ethics, which can also bring in the dimension of action, of living in community, and so forth. And when the nature of the training was conceptualized, there were always these three parts. And we focus especially, we being sort of the mainstream Western communities, focus especially on meditation and bring in wisdom some. I think that wisdom's been brought in a lot more. You know, when I was first teaching, starting to teach in California, I worked with Sylvia Borstein, and we had a group for senior students starting in the early 1990s. And Sylvia did a lot of the teaching, and I arranged a lot of the curriculum. And we found, you know, we went through a lot of teachings, and I found out that even senior students were really not very well grounded, even in the core wisdom teachings. I think that may have changed some over the years, but that time that was the case, you know. And ethics clearly comes in third place, so to speak. And so I want to explore that. So there's a very powerful set of really ethical guidelines that Thich Nhat Hanh developed, which I quoted from in part last time. These are called the precepts of the order of interbeing. And Thich Nhat Hanh articulated these in 1966, right at the heart of the war when he was still in Vietnam. And he created what he called the order of interbeing. In Vietnamese, some of you may know the Vietnamese term, it's Thiep Hien, T-I-E-P-H-I-E-N. And he created an order for people who were dedicated to following these 14 precepts, these 14 ethical precepts. And there were very few people in the order originally. There only were six people. They were the members of his board for the organization he had earlier created called the Buddhist Youth for Social Service, which brought together about 10,000 people meeting the different needs during the war. So I want to show you just briefly the 14 precepts. Let's see. Let's see. Okay, here's full screen mode. Okay, so I won't read these all, but you can see that they're a list and they go down further. There are 14 of them, starting with do not be idolatrous about or bound to any doctrine, theory, or ideology, even Buddhist ones. Buddhist systems of thought are guiding means. They are not absolute truth. Do not think the knowledge you presently possess is changeless, absolute truth. Down to the fourth, do not avoid contact with suffering or close your eyes before suffering. And I'll go through these in the course of my talk, come back to each of them and group them under the five core ethical precepts. So you can see down at the bottom, very powerfully, number 12, do not kill. Do not let others kill. Find whatever means possible to protect life and prevent war, and so forth. So I'll go through those, and I can get that list of the precepts. I could get that to you, Bill, if you want to post that for the talk. And so that's an early version. And some of you know Thich Nhat Hanh compiled another set of reflections in 1993 called For a Future to be Possible, in which he went further into the nature of the ethical precepts. So we know that the traditional precepts are expressed very simply, the way that we often express them at retreats goes something like this. For the sake of training, I undertake the precept to abstain from the taking of life. For the sake of training, the second precept, I undertake the precept not to take that which is not given. So we would say that's not stealing. The first is not killing. For the sake of training, I undertake the precept to abstain from sexual misconduct. For the sake of training, the fourth, I undertake the precept to abstain from unwise speech. For the sake of training, I undertake the precept to abstain from intoxicants that cause heedlessness. And so most broadly, the usual sense of the precepts is they're about living a life of non-harming, of not hurting others. And they also can be understood as bringing about positive qualities. The first precept on non-harming can be understood in terms of bringing care into the world. The second precept about not taking that which is not given can be connected with developing generosity. And again, the third through the fifth are about bringing our attention to situations which can often bring about problems. Sexuality, speech, and intoxicants. Sometimes a situation can involve all three, as we know. And so what I want to do is to focus particularly on the expansion of the ethical precepts beyond the way that we typically probably interpret them, as mostly about our face-to-face, interpersonal way of being with others, way of being with ourselves. Because I think what Thich Nhat Hanh was doing was giving a powerful expansion of the ethical precepts in a way that is deeply relevant to our present time, where I believe the ethical precepts, when they're understood, in a broad way are the basis for our acting in the world, as well as how we act with people close to us. And this is really what Thich Nhat Hanh was offering. You know, when he says, do not kill, do not let others kill, right? There's a very powerful sense there. It's not just about me not killing, but what do I do when my government kills in my name, particularly in a democratic or quasi-democratic society where I have some ability to influence the government. Thich Nhat Hanh is basically saying that there is any killing anywhere is my ethical responsibility. So it's a lot, right? It's saying that where there is harm being done, this is my responsibility. So it can really lead us to ask, if I want to follow an ethical life, is it simply about how I am in my own little, you know, part of the world with people close to me? Or does it become important to have a broader sense of ethics? Thich Nhat Hanh is certainly answering yes. And I would answer yes as well. And that's what I want to explore. So I'll go one by one through the precepts, and I'll bring in the ways that Thich Nhat Hanh in those 14 precepts brought in understandings of each of the five. And I'll partly refer to some of what he also wrote later, and I'll bring in some of my own understandings. And I'm also at times refer to the way that the Buddha explicated the different ethical precepts. So interesting that the first ethical precept could be said to be about non-harming, non-killing. And it's interesting that this is, way prior to Thich Nhat Hanh, is actually said to be the most important of the five precepts. In fact, the Buddha says this is the distinguishing mark of Dhamma, he said once. The distinguishing mark of all the teachings of liberation is non-harming. Right? Interesting that he said that. So again, it's showing the importance that here that the Buddha gave to the ethical guidelines. When we follow the first precept, the Buddha said, we abandon, this is a quote, we abandon the onslaught on breathing beings. Without stick or sword, scrupulous, compassionate, trembling for the welfare of all living beings. So this is also obviously not just human beings. Care for the well-being of all. And believe it or not, in some later times when there were Buddhist rulers, which happened from time to time, such as Ashoka, just a few hundred years after the Buddha, well over 2,000 years ago, there was an outlawing of capital punishment well over 2,000 years ago, sort of reaching levels of having a government that followed the precepts in many ways way more than ours does. Right? So it's very interesting. So we can find that. And I also think it's important that this first precept is connected with this very deep teaching that goes way back in India to pre-Buddhist times, which comes forward as what's called ahimsa, non-harming, which is also the basis for Gandhi's work and the traditions of non-violence, which have been so crucial in the last century. Those are very closely connected with the first ethical precept. For Thich Nhat Hanh, in the order of interbeing, the most central guideline was, as I mentioned, do not kill, do not let others kill, find whatever means possible to protect life and prevent war. So again, a very, very tall order. And interesting to see that this is not totally, this more expanded notion of ethics is not totally modern. It's not entirely an innovation from Thich Nhat Hanh or others. That actually, when you go back to some of the texts of the Buddha, you can find him saying, do not kill. And then the way it comes forth in translation, do not cause others to kill. And so there's a sense that it's not just about what we do face to face. And we can interpret do not cause others to kill as meaning what a government does in my name, since I have a certain degree of responsibility for what the government does. In his later reflections on this first precept, Thich Nhat Hanh said, aware of the suffering caused by the destruction of life, I vow to cultivate compassion and learn ways to protect the lives of peoples, animals, plants, and minerals. I am determined not to kill, not to let others kill, not to condone any act of killing in the world. So again, very tall order in my thinking and in my way of life. We cannot support any act of killing. No killing can be justified, but not to kill is not enough. We must also learn ways to prevent others from killing. We cannot say I am not responsible. They did it. My hands are clean. If you were in Germany during the time of the Nazis, you could not say they did it. I did not. So, you know, I brought this up, that quote up last time, but it's a very powerful one to really ask us, if we take the ethical precepts seriously, what's our responsibility right now? You know, with a possible war looming in Europe, with violence done in many, many ways. You know, what do I feel called to do? How might I respond? And the fourth precept from the Tiepan Order says, be in touch with the suffering, with the violence of the world. Do not avoid contact with suffering or close your eyes. Do not lose awareness of the existence of suffering in the life of the world. Find ways to be with those who are suffering by all means, including personal contact and visits, images and sounds. By these means, awaken yourself and others to the reality of suffering in the world. This is a way of expanding the first precept. You know, he also says, the 11th precept says, do not live with a vocation that is harmful to humans and nature. Do not invest in companies that deprive others of their chance to live. Select a vocation that helps you realize your ideal of compassion. So it's also, we could ask, where, if I have savings, where are my savings going? Are they creating harm? I'm sure many or maybe all of us have reflected on that and looked into that. This is from the Thai Buddhist teacher and organizer, Sulak Sivaraksha. He said, we must look at the sales of arms and challenge these structures, economic and political, which are responsible for murder. Killing permeates our modern way of life. Wars, racial conflicts, breeding animals to serve human markets, and using harmful insecticides. How can we create a nonviolent society? How can the first precept and its ennobling virtues be used to shape a politically just and merciful world? Again, how can I respond, in this case, to killing? How can I see that as part of my responsibility as a practitioner? The second precept, traditionally about not taking that which is not given, what do we do again when we're in a, let's say, economic system, which takes from some and enriches others, whether it's in this country or worldwide, or which has done so certainly historically. Again, some of the Chepen precepts from Thich Nhat Hanh bring this out as well. He says, possess nothing that should belong to others, and also prevent others from enriching themselves from human suffering or the suffering of other beings. The fifth precept says, do not accumulate wealth while millions are hungry. Live simply and share time, energy, and material resources with those who are in need. Again, this is from 1966, right in the middle of an intense crisis, right? So how is this impacting us? How might we really let this inspire us as well as challenge us to deepen our ethical practice? The third precept is about being careful about sexuality, being wise, careful, respectful. The 14th precept for Thich Nhat Hanh goes like this. Do not mistreat your body. Learn to handle it with respect. Preserve vital energy, sexual breath, spirit, for the realization of the way. Be fully aware of the responsibility of bringing new lives into the world. Meditate on the world into which you are bringing new beings. And so, again, when we have a more expanded version, what's my responsibility, for example, to respond to sexual violence or to sexism, you know, particularly the objectification of women? You know, what's my responsibility to look deeply at my own conditioning around gender, you know, whether I'm whatever gender I am, however I see that? And some of us may be called to act against some of the harm created by unskillful or really negative or exploitative approaches to sexuality. In a similar way, there's the fourth precept on wise speech. And I teach on this a lot, and I think many of us probably remember at least the way that I frame it in terms of there being five guidelines from the Buddha on wise speech. This is the traditional understanding: to be truthful, to be helpful, to be coming from a good heart, to have good timing, you know, to be appropriate, actually four. And I think wise speech and skillful speech is very, very central for Thich Nhat Hanh. And in this 1966 articulation of an expanded understanding of ethics in the context of crisis. The eighth precept for in the order of interbeing goes like this. Do not utter words that can create discord and cause the community to break. Make every effort to reconcile and resolve all conflicts, however small. Remember, this was the set of ethical precepts for a community of people acting at a time of crisis, but also interacting with each other, working together. The ninth precept in the Chepien order goes like this. Do not say untruthful things for the sake of personal interest or to impress people. So back then, 1966, the height of the Vietnam War, Thich Nhat Hanh was encouraging people not to talk too much in a way that tries to impress others, right? That was still happening. Human beings. Do not utter words that cause division and hatred. Do not spread news that you do not know to be certain. That has some relevance for our times, right? Do not criticize or condemn things of which you are not sure. Always speak truthfully and constructively. Those are the first two of the Buddha's guidelines. Have the courage to speak out about situations of injustice, even when doing so may threaten your own safety. Right? So an expansive understanding of skillful speech, of wise speech. And also very prominent, I think related very much to speech, in the guidelines were several precepts about how we hold views, how we hold understandings. You remember I read earlier, do not be idolatrous or bound to any doctrine, theory, or ideology, even Buddhist ones. Buddhist systems of thought are guiding means. They are not absolute truth. How do we get attached to our views? Second precept, do not think that the knowledge you presently possess is changeless, absolute truth. Avoid being narrow-minded and bound to present views. Learn and practice non-attachment from views in order to be open to receive others' viewpoints. Truth is found in life and not merely in conceptual knowledge. Be ready to learn throughout your entire life and observe reality in yourself and in the world at all times. And then the third guideline in relation to children, do not force others, including children, by any means whatsoever to adopt your views. However, through compassionate dialogue, help others renounce fanaticism and narrowness. So how do we bring that expansion of the fourth precept into our lives? I think it suggests that we have a responsibility to help bring about a world in which there's more truthfulness, in which there's more skillful speech. What's our responsibility in a world which has so many lies, so many deliberate untruths, you know, of course, by a lot of people in power? How do we relate to that? How do we try to see that as part of our responsibility to act ethically? That can really, for some of us, that might be something that leads us to say, I want to, you know, I don't know, help monitor what's truthful or not about a given situation. You know, obviously, all sorts of issues related to COVID misinformation and disinformation, but could be about all sorts of issues. And then the last precept is about using substances which lead to heedlessness. And Thich Nhat Hanh gives a very broad sense of this. He actually thinks about it as, what is our diet? What do we bring in? He gives account, he says, it's about mindful consumption of what is helpful or harmful to our mind and body in general, including conversations and information. A proper diet, he says, is crucial for self-transformation and for the transformation of society. So again, if we have an expanded view of this precept, it might be to work for a saner drug policy. You know, which think there's some movement, but there's still a lot of way to go on this. Also realizing that so many people, particularly Black and brown people, are still in jail for drug offenses. And I think we know that they are arrested for drug offenses at a much higher percentage than the number of users. And we know the drug laws can be really, really destructive and have been. You know, I have a first cousin who probably when he was in his 20s, he was caught basically dealing drugs in the early 1970s. And he actually went underground for almost 25 years. The crazy drug laws deeply affected his life. He eventually chose to come back and go to prison, which he was in, I think, for a fairly short time, but it was still a while. And when he came out, he thought he'd be going back to his life, but within a few years, he actually got sick and died at a young age. So I know firsthand some of the effects of these drug laws, right? And I think we know that they're very harmful. And so that could be a basis for acting, you know, to really know that the laws are can be very, very destructive. And so there are, again, these multiple levels. And then I wanted to give the 10th guideline is something that's that from Thich Nhat Hanh from 1966. It's really about community life. And I wanted to really close with this. This is his guidance for how a community, how we work with the community. The 10th guideline says, do not use the Buddhist community for personal gain or profit, or transform your community into a political party. I don't think there's been too much danger of that at Marin Sangha, but that's the guidance. There were certain dangers in Vietnam. A religious community, however, should take a clear stand against oppression and injustice and should strive to change the situation without engaging in partisan conflicts. So this is, again, saying in a way that all of these precepts are appropriate for us as individuals to follow and have that expanded sense of ethics. But it's also, he's saying, appropriate for the community to consider the Sangha to be understood as an actor, we might say, that the community can act as well. And I don't know how much Marin Sangha has done. There are certain kinds of actions and related in relation to the homeless, right? That's responding to Thich Nhat Hanh's invitation, right? But there might be other ways that can be understood, you know, whether it's statements, action, joining in various ways. That is also one of the precepts that Thich Nhat Hanh gives that expands the sense of ethics. So let me finish now just with a moment, inviting a moment of reflection for each of us, then we can open up to discussion. So when you heard these precepts and maybe thought of particular issues, which of them resonated the most with you? I'll give a series of questions and invite some silent reflection. So what resonated with you as I was speaking? Which of the ethical precepts and maybe what issues came up for you? Does reflection on this broader way of holding the ethical precepts spark in you a desire to act on a certain issue or make a commitment? If so, what might you do? What steps might you take? And if you're already working on a particular concern or issue, does the clarification of the ethical basis for action, do you find that helpful? Can it give you maybe more energy for your action? So I find this way of understanding the ethical precepts quite challenging. You know, it really challenges me. Am I really taking the precepts seriously? How might I take them more fully? Again, it can be a corrective to the way that we focus so much on meditation and inner work. And this is very clearly a traditional part of our training. And I find it challenging, and it's a good kind of challenge. So with that, let me open things up to any reflections, questions, sharing of how you've worked with the ethical precepts in this way. Anywhere you'd like to go. Okay, it looks like Barbara and Bill, please.
Yeah, you know, there's something that I like about the five precepts in that they are about intention and behavior, and they're within my grasp all the time.
Mm-hmm.
That is, I'm always capable of being a little bit better about wise speech, say.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the precepts from Thich Nhat Hanh are so demanding, like stop war everywhere. I'm more likely to just throw up my hands and say, the hell with that. I can't do that. Give me a gin and tonic instead. So I think that's, for me, that's a problem with some of his asks are so far beyond my grasp that I just throw up my hands in despair.
Well, since you got the square, I'll go in, because I found the whole thing about not killing and not letting others kill very inspiring. And I think that part of it is not to sort of take off with these, expand it so much it becomes impossible. But I think about, don't let others kill you. Let's go through our investments and see what's going on. You know, something that simple. You know, or don't, the other one I like was, do not avoid contact with suffering. You know, there are a lot of suffering people that could be visited, could be helped, you know, could be, you know, worked with. So I was inspired by a lot of them.
Right. Yeah. Some of them, I really did like the one about being, you know, not turning away from suffering, because there's nothing in the five precepts that says, you know, that you shouldn't turn away from suffering. And I think that's really important, is to embrace our own suffering and the suffering of others.
Right. Yeah. So thank you, Bill and Barbara. And just, I have a few reflections. Yeah. How many people can relate to what Bill said about it being kind of a tall order? How do I deal with this? I have two thoughts on that. One of them, there's a lot in Buddhist practice which is a tall order. Awakening is not a small thing. I somehow heard that that's part of it too, right? Awakening. And so that is a tall order. Developing a heart that's radiant with metta towards all beings. That's a pretty tall order too. So I think it's helpful really to see a lot of what we're offered as being challenging, being in some ways beyond our present state, but it can be seen to be a direction. You know, certainly awakening is that way, metta for all beings is that way. And so we can, even for something like do not let others kill, we may find that we're called to act on that in some way. But I think, you know, there's also the question of how do I respond to some of the large systemic issues? And we can't do everything, but maybe, you know, maybe really taking the expanded sense of ethics more seriously might help me to say, yeah, I really want to do a little bit more around climate issues, or I want to do a little bit more around issues of violence. You know, and it's, so it might be, you know, like I was affected a lot by one of my students, I think about 2 years ago. She came and said, and she was someone who was a teacher and a meditator, and she said, I really want to act more. And so we went through a process, and I said, what issue do you want to work with? And she said, climate issues. And then I said, how much time do you have per week? And she said, I've got 5 hours to devote. And then I had her research what she might do in 5 hours, is mostly researching a few organizations. she found something that really worked for her, and she did it. And she's been doing it ever since, right? And it can be something like that, or, you know, it doesn't have to be 5 hours, but what it's really saying, I want to do that. Can we engage in ethical practice, you know, maybe with a certain amount of time that maybe is close to how much we meditate? Some of us may want to do that. So I think we can just really find the systemic issue that calls us. We don't have to do everything. We can't do everything. And then, let's see, and then Barbara, can you remind me the point you made briefly?
I was talking about not letting others kill and being present to suffering.
Yeah,
and examining my investments and my how do I save money and where, you know.
Right, so that's a part of it. So I think I'm bringing this up really to have us ask ourselves. And so there are a lot of, Bill, maybe this is the response. There are a lot of small things we can do which are actually doable, not too hard, right? That's how I would think I would answer that. Not to make it too big or get too despairing, or I can't do that, or the problem is too big, right? Oh, climate change, too big. Oh, violence in the world, too big. But I think, you know what, I think there are ways that we can act, and actually what will resolve these issues is having, like, I think if 5% of the population put in 5 hours a week, it would be amazing. There'd be changes. And that's doable. Please, Mary.
I sort of recognize that I, as an individual, can't do a lot, but I can help elect people who do have the power to do things. So I've been involved very much in the last 5-6 years with Swing Left, which goes and does a lot of letter writing, postcarding, phoning to get people elected all around the country. And Northern California, and particularly Marin County, and I, and this was largely a group of people called Swing Left, have been very responsible. They were the ones who got the blue wave in the House in 2018. I mean, this is just by the work of phoning and postcarding and that sort of thing. So if anybody's interested, I've got 200 postcards right now ready to be written. And just let me know and we'll get together and I'll get you some postcards.
Thanks, Mary. Yeah, and there are, I know the Berkeley Zen Center has had an election session where they've gone to a particular electoral race, which was sort of up for grabs. I think what I'm particularly encouraging is to see this as part of one's ethical practice and to take one's ethical practice seriously. You know, and again, that's something that's sometimes not done, again, with the emphasis on meditation being so strong. Please, Linda. And Vita, do you want to be on the line?
Depending on how much time you have.
Okay.
Just quickly, there was two things that struck me. The one was one on using substances and consumption. And I really never thought about what I take in through the media as consumption.
Yeah.
And you know, the time I'm spending doing that and where am I putting my attention? You know, it's been a lot of Olympics the last couple of weeks. And which is very wholesome, but is that really the best use of my time and attention? The other thing I wanted to mention was under the not taking the, what is not freely given is in a group I'm reading with on dismantling racism, we've talked a lot about land acknowledgments and donating to some of the indigenous people's causes. And even they're looking, there's something called like a land tax, and you look at your income and where you live and how much you have, and kind of figure out what would be ethical for you to pay back.
Yeah, there's a lot there. I mean, I think Bruce Coburn, who's Canadian, had a song called Stolen Land, right? Some of you remember that one, right? But we are all on basically stolen land, right? And it's normalized. That's a lot to come to grips with, right? So what you're bringing up is one way to explore that, and it's not easy, and it can be messy and so forth. But you know, I think that's part of what's happening now, isn't it? Yeah. Let's see. Yeah, if you can do the raised hand function that we have kind of a cue. Liz, I see. Hi. Also. Vita and Deborah had their hands up. Yeah.
Well, I think that's why they call this a practice. It is a practice.
That's right.
It's continuous, and there's so much that we can do. I agree with Mary. I mean, I did a lot of political work in the last election. A lot needs to be done coming up in the coming elections, a huge amount of work to make sure that we support people who will be helpful and kind, and also supporting organizations who can do a lot of the work for us. I contribute to the ACLU monthly for years.
Mm-hmm.
So just supporting organizations that we know will do a lot of the work for us, and we can do that. So I think there's just a huge amount that we can do.
Many, 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 many ways. And again, I'm at the risk of repeating myself, what I'm wanting to do is see this as continuous with our meditation or our study of the Four Noble Truths. This is part of practice, and to have this be active in our lives. And again, Thich Nhat Hanh gives us almost more than anyone else, you know, a broadened sense of what ethical practice is about.
And James Barras and Oren did a huge amount of work in the last election.
Mm-hmm.
And Oren was chastised by our Sangha for sending out political messages. But, you know, the Buddhism has changed in the last couple of years, and teachers are very political.
Yeah, thank you, Liz. Vita, do you want to go, or Deborah?
Yeah, I'll really quick. I just want to thank you again, as always. So somehow I do I belong to a group called 1,000 Grandmothers. And we do a lot of work with Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities. And somehow I can now connect it to Dhamma.
Yeah.
And I live in a community where, in fact, there is a lot of unfairness and not discrimination in terms of color, but unfairness and favoritism. And you've given me, I don't know, I will probably do more than I have done to work with that. So somehow it's like connected this life with that life to this life. Yeah. I don't know if that made sense, but I want to thank you for it anyway.
Yeah, it does. That's really was my larger intention here, is to give us a broader sense of practice. Again, for different reasons, some of which are very understandable, a lot of us have tended to focus primarily on meditation. And even, you know, people talk to each other and say, how's your practice going? And the answer is, it's good. I sit 20 minutes a day now, right? That might be an answer, but that shows a more narrow sense of practice. And what I'm encouraging, I didn't say so much about wisdom. Wisdom plays a very large role as well. Again, the traditional model is training in Pali, it's Sila Samadhi Panya, translated as wisdom in a little different order, wisdom, meditation, and ethics or action. And that was a lot of my motivation, was to, you know, bring forth, again, energized by Thich Nhat Hanh, bring forth this broader sense of what practice is. Yeah. And maybe last one, Deborah, please.
So a couple of people have already said this. There is a lot you can do without leaving your house. I have been active in, of course, I can't remember the name right now, but it's Indigenous Rights in the Amazon, actually. And I've been supporting that organization and other organizations, Color of Change, which is primarily Black people fighting for justice for people in prisons and environmental justice. So there are lots of organizations that we can just sign petitions. I know there are some who think that doesn't mean anything, but I believe that it does, that people at least know they're being supported, that their emails are being read, contributions are being made. So there are a lot of things we can do just sitting here on our heating pads. The other thing about right speech, very quickly, I've been trying to practice a lot more on equanimity the last few weeks or several weeks. Yes, metta, of course, and being aware and mindful and following my breath, but I'm trying to cultivate more equanimity regardless of what's going on, because there is so much going on in the body, in the world, in the environment, everywhere. And there are times I'm kind of dancing around a few issues where speaking up might in fact, it might come from a hard place. It might be truth or my truth, but it might cause discord for the listener. So I'm kind of working on that, trying to be kind, trying to be timely, trying to be honest, trying to be helpful, and it might cause discord. And I have to work that out because the boundary changes from situation to situation or from moment to moment.
Yeah, and there's some tricky issues there. And even I think when I read the precept from Thich Nhat Hanh, I'm not sure about the translation because, you know, in some situations, you know, think of someone like Dr. King, civil, you know, nonviolent action often brings about a certain kind of discord in an unjust situation, and that can be a good thing, right? Or a problematic situation. So I think a lot of it is the motivation. And, you know, it's, so one can, it really is about one's motivation. And, you know, I mean, I even, you know, remember that, you know, from the last weeks, you know, one of the motivations to ban so-called critical race theory from the classrooms is that it might cause discomfort to someone. Right. So I think there is definitely a place for being skillful in ways that could lead to people being upset or lead to dealing with the situation in a way that has aspects of conflict. You know, to point to injustice might lead to a sense of a problem or a conflict or discord. So it's tricky when we look at that one.
No. Thank you. I like the reminder about motivation. I think I said here a few weeks ago, the acronym WAIT, why am I talking? So thank you for that, motivation.
You're welcome.